is sort of catchy, and maybe you raised some questions with you and sort of aroused your curiosity and everything. But basically, this was an article that came out about 3 years ago in different scholarly journals by a professor in American history and American society at Harvard by the name of Robert Putnam. And that the name is on the board. And what he had found in looking at various statistics, and he was familiar with various kinds of statistical analysis, was something that was in a way quirky, but in a way it was indicated, you know, a larger problem. That is, even though the number of people who are going in or taking up bowling for the first time has increased, and increased something like 30% over the pace the space of about 2 years, the total number of people in the country who were bowling, you know, compared to earlier times, went down significantly. Team bowling went down, individual bowling went up. And I was looking, and I found a fascinating piece, and I'll be glad to share this later if you want. One reason solo bowling is going up, and this is in the American Airlines, you know, monthly news magazine, and it's going up is because what they've done is glamorized bowling. Now you have what they call the day glow painting, or things that they have bowling at night in the dark, but your bowling ball and your pins and your lanes are all painted with this day glow. Is that what you call it stuff? I'll send it around and see what you think of it. But I want to read the statistics first on this. Glow-in-the-dark bowling is what's catching on. With all its special effects and sensations, has helped buoy a sport that until recently was sinking in a rising sea of recreational options. Since the early 1980s, participation in the sport has waned. League play has dropped considerably, and facilities have aged and fallen into disrepair. Hundreds of bowling alleys have called it quits. Then came the glow. In the past 4 years, at least a third of the 6,800 bowling centers in the country have revamped their facilities so they can offer glow bowling, trademark within their trademark things, and hundreds more are following in suit. It's so popular, in fact, especially among teens and young adults, that the Palisades feature four sessions each weekend. That's a big one out on the coast. On Saturday nights, the 10 o'clock session runs for 2.5 hours. Then the house is cleared, and the second two-hour session starts at 1 o'clock in the morning. So there are innovations here, but the important point is that it's still an individualist sort of thing. Now, he say, well, why should people take anything as quirky or as strange as a sort of offbeat as solo bowling is an indication of some major, you know, trend that's taken place in this country. And his argument to get serious here is that what's happening in this country, and he's got lots of statistics here, is there's been a decline in the term I have on the board here, social capital. I want to explain that there's serious decline in what we call social capital. Now, I mean, if this isn't clear, if I can't make it clear, by all means ask me on this. That refers to the networks, the norms, the communities, the goodwill, the social trust that we have in getting things done, facing problems and issues and matters, together. The social capital, the idea that we trust each other and that we're willing to work together to solve many of the problems locally or regionally or statewide, whatever it might be. And that would be in such things as, and I'll talk about this in great length, I want to be sure the social capital definition is clear. That would be in such things as PTA, that'd be in volunteer organizations. PTA, Red Cross, Lions, Kiwanis, Rotary, League of Women Voters, AARP, and I'm sure many of you have sent in your $5 for AARP and have your little red and white and blue card back for this that you use at Motel 6, you know, when you're going into, you're cruising across Nebraska and you're stopping at Ogallala, or if not there, another real hot spot is Cosette. And I think in Nebraska they have three things going. I got off the subject already. They have, you know, Big Red, football, they have motels, and they have livestock. I think those are the three. And there isn't really a whole lot of differentiations. I swear, in North Platte, there's nothing going on in North Platte except motels. I don't know, we've made the tour many times across and everything else. And anyway, back to rewinding back where we're on social capital. The idea being that there is sort of a fund, or like a banker would call it, a capital of goodwill on which we can draw to make our lives easier. And what Putnam argues is that for reasons which we want to go into here, this fund, including this gets into church membership also, and church participation, is going down significantly, you know, in this particular decade. All right, he said that that's a real loss. So the loss of social capital, he said, is a real loss, and he has sort of three reasons for this. He said life is easier. He said life is more rewarding in a community blessed with substantial stock of social capital, where you come and you participate freely and openly because you want to, because there's sort of a common goal, and people understand the need for this, even though it might interfere with some of their, you know, their private lives. He says this, we respond more freely. We encourage more social trust. We solve our mutual problems more quickly and easily when we can depend on this fund or draw on this fund of social capital. There's a chair up here if you want to come in here's a chair up in front. I know Lutherans have trouble. No, he didn't want to sit in front. Okay. I shouldn't have said that. Sure. Scratch that from the tape. Okay. Put it another way. He said, when there is a trust that we know we can come together, that we can draw on social capital, that gives us a great deal of optimism for the future. We have much more optimism in being able to think that we can really deal with these problems on this particular basis once we have solved these problems. But the more we lose in social capital, the more difficult it will be to solve these problems. And I think maybe some of you can think of your own communities where this is a problem. I see Sigurd from Northfield, and we're having a real problem, for instance, in solving the issue of the design of Highway 3 from about Dairy Queen down to, you know, to Main Street. And they've been arguing about that for 4 years, and the State Department of Highways doesn't want to do anything until they get the people, you know, united on this, but the people don't want to be united on this, and they distrust each other, and every time there's a hearing, there's a major, you know, demonstration and uproar and so on. So it's too bad, because now there's little confidence that we can ever solve it, and since we have to solve it sometimes, what happens, that the problems then go back to, you know, in our capital, St. Paul, and they'll solve it for us, and then everybody will get mad because they'll say that all these guys up in St. Paul are doing what we should have been doing for ourselves. But there's a problem here of keeping social capital alive so you have real confidence in the future. And third, he makes the point, and we want to talk about this, I remember this article was written about 4 years ago. We do live in a world of pessimism, of cynicism, of doubt, whether we really can solve our social problems. And he argues that once we sort of build up a fund of social capital, we learn to sort of get out of ourselves and to see matters as they affect the community or the congregation or, you know, a larger community or the school in a way which is beneficial to all, not just sort of protecting our own turf or protecting our own particular kinds of interests. And he said, we find richer meanings and rewards in this life when we learn to trust, when we learn to work together and help each other out. He said, what's happening in this country, and this was written in the early 90s, this was not written, you know, 2 days after the Monica Lewinsky speech or anything else like that. And but all of the thing I'm saying here is that, if anything, his argument clearly predicts what's happened since that point on. We can talk about that later. Okay. He said, we really aren't the people we once were. I'm reading a wonderful book, and I want to plug it here. It's in the bookstore. Kathleen Norris, and it's simply called Dakota. And, oh, it's a marvel. I'm just taken with it. Because, I mean, I wouldn't want to live there in Lemon, North, South Dakota. But she makes a very strong case why this is a very rewarding, nourishing kind of experience, and she compares it to living in a monastery. I like that because sometimes it's just about as austere and simple. But it's Kathleen Norris, Dakota, as is the book, and I have to put in a plug. I'm not even putting in a plug now for the book here, Warren. But I wrote a book, 25 Bicycle Trails in Southeast Minnesota, and available soon at your favorite bookstore. But anyway, what happened with me that I got in touch with my roots again. I got in touch with small towns and rivers and lakes and small congregations and things like that, where there still is some vestige of social capital that's there. And she shows that in some cases, and I learned in some cases too, social capital really does help bring these things together, and in some cases it doesn't. In my little home of Kenyon, and the big rival was always Wanamingo. And what happened with the refinancing of state taxes and everything else, they've had to merge the two schools. And if you ever thought that would have happened even 10 years ago, no way, but they've learned to come together. Among other things, the state said the State Department of Education told them if they don't come together, there'll be no school. That sort of speeded up the the process here of negotiation and compromise, but they are learning. My brother, the one I, you know, with a good sense of humor, who's always telling me these things, was on the school board and talking about negotiation and working back and forth. And they've decided on the junior and senior high is going to be in one town, and the elementary school is going to be on the other. And the thing that saves it, of course, is the school bus. And other things, too, and I'll talk about this later, internet teaching, or teaching, you know, having one place and then having the lessons go out four or five other places. And you say, whatever happened to the one-room schoolhouse, obviously it's gone, and it's gone, you know, forever, and we can be nostalgic about it and everything else. But the new social capital, in some cases, in this particular case, is working quite well. I was amused, though, that we had our 50th anniversary, as I said, and people came back and they said, well, whatever happened to the name Kenyan Vikings? And shouldn't, if we're going to be here, shouldn't it be the Kenyan Wanamingo Vikings? And the Wanamingo people didn't want to be known as the Vikings. They were the Bulldogs, so they had to compromise on another name. But at least they got together and did compromise and didn't have a dash name. You know, they, wouldn't that look good? Let's have a cheer for the Vikings dash Bulldogs. That would, like, hyphenate the names and marriages is what I'm getting at, obviously, there. So that got Warren all broken up over that one. So is that clear so far on sort of the basic point he's trying to make about social capital? And then we want to look at sort of the evidence and spend most of the time here, what kind of evidence does he have? Because sometimes when you hear bold statements of interpretation and, you know, very exciting new concepts about what's right or what's wrong with, you know, with America, usually you can say that that article was written without fear. Everybody gets excited about that article was written without fear and without research. This was written without fear and written with research. I don't know if you people in geology have to be much more careful about your evidence because you have to put it out there.
You get lots of it.
You get lots of evidence, right. Some of it good and some of it not so good, right. Okay, now, for instance, the big field of politics. Remember, this was written in the early 90s. And there are some very, you know, disturbing situations here. We've had a serious decline in turnout for national elections, you know, in the last three decades. A very serious decline in the number of people who turn out for the national elections. That is, they go up to the place once every 4 years and vote. Now, there are some counter trends here. For instance, we in Scottsdale vote by mail. And sometimes they have the ballot places open for 2 weeks, and not just on the first Tuesday after the first Monday, you know, in November. And so there are some attempts at trying to do something about this. And but basically the thrust here of the evidence, I think, is clear. That is, some 25% people now perform the most basic and the simple task of voting than that was the case 3 decades ago. The same thing is true in state and local politics. And by way of contrast, this is not the case, you know, in Canada, our closest neighbor. There's still a very high turnout in national elections in Canada. And in Europe, this is where the story real comes in Western Europe, they are getting, you know, 90 to 95% of the people in the Scandinavian countries, Germany, Britain, and France, and these countries coming out. For one thing, they vote on Sunday, which is a well-established kind of tradition. But basically, you know, the number of people who vote has gone down something like 25%, down 25% on this thing. All right. The same thing is true, really, psychologically, with the statistics here. In the last 30 years, the number of people who say they distrust the officials in Washington, who distrust the people in Washington, has risen from 30 to 75% in the last 3 years. And this was in 1992, when it was Dole versus, no, it was Bush versus you know, Clinton in 1992, okay. In 1992, this was the statistics, the number of people who say they don't trust the government has risen from 30 to 75%. That's not a blip, you know, on the screen of these statistics. That's a very compelling kind of figure. Okay. And this is not true, you see, in Europe. That's the point. So it's something that's going on in this country, because we compare ourselves, I think, quite fairly to what was happening in Europe. You know, they're westernized and they're industrialized and urbanized and all these things. You get the idea. Okay. The same thing is true, and then I'll go into the details on this, of the voluntary associations that we have in this country. PTAs, sports groups, professional societies, all these groups are showing a significant decline in membership and participation. There has been, of course, the boom, which has pretty much now leveled off, of growth in churches, of those we call the fundamentalist and the evangelical churches on that, but that's somewhat leveled off. But the overall trend here is that from 1960 to 1990 in this country, overall, the attendance in churches and synagogues in this country has gone down 18%. That's a huge number, some 18%, even though there are some places like the Mormons go up, and Jehovah's Witness, and once in a while these things, and they keep up. But that's a fascinating, you know, sort of model here, because it raises the question, they are so well organized, and there's so much group cohesion in a, a group like Jehovah's Witness or Mormons, that they put the rest of us really to shame. Maybe some of you have seen places where this is true. If you see a new truck, a moving van in town, Beacons or Mayflower or whatever it is, within 2 hours, they're unloading, within 2 hours, there's a Mormon woman there, you know, with a hot dish at that place with a welcome. And you know, they are very cohesive, and they don't have trouble getting, Jehovah's Witness don't have trouble getting people out on Saturday morning with their copies of, you know, of the Watchtower. There are all kinds of things to be said sort of on the other side too, but at least they have their people organized. And if you ever, for instance, we can talk a lot about the Mormons, if you've ever gone by a Mormon church parking lot like the middle or late Sunday afternoon, it's still full. I mean, they're there in the morning, but when they go to church on Sunday, they go, you know, all the time. Does it ring a bell? Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. Very close to our home.
Next door.
Practically next door to the Mormon. One of the headquarters.
Right.
They're busy all the time.
They're busy all the time. They have it 7 days a week, right?
Yeah.
And you can, all the other things, there are no Mormons on welfare, and that's all true. And there are all sorts of things on the other side that can be said also. But you get the idea here that even though there is a large increase in the total population in this country, with all the people we talked about yesterday, all the new immigrants and all the rest coming in, there still is a decline in the number of people going to churches. Some exceptions like this, the Latinos, for instance, in Los Angeles, who are going to the Catholic Church, of course, because that was the church of their ancestry, but basically that's the case. Okay. Or another thing within churches, I don't know if any of you can remember, but many churches for a long time into the 50s and the 60s had what we call the Sunday night prayer meeting. This was simply established and accepted that there was a more informal, you know, kind of service on Sunday evenings, and almost all churches had them. I remember we went, and sometimes as a teenager I wasn't all that excited about going for Sunday night prayer meeting. But this has changed, and to where many of them don't have that anymore. Here's a question, and then
just
I'll repeat it.
Just to clarify, when you're speaking churches, are you including houses of worship or Muslim?
No.
Gathering places?
No,
or strictly churches and synagogues?
And churches and synagogues, right, not Muslims. And he doesn't include that because we didn't start picking up on the Muslim attendance until in the 1990s. And now when we talk about churches and synagogues in this country, we have to add mosques, and this is being done. But not, they're not here, because if they did have service, they go, what is it, five times a day? Isn't it, they have prayer, I think it is. They have a mosque or a temple down at right next to the university at ASU, and they ring out the bells and all the rest, and they go all the time. All right. The point here, though, is that other things have happened to change this, and I think one thing, and see if your memory backs me up on this, that helped sort of bring down the Mondays, the Sunday night prayer meeting, was the rise of quality television programs at night. And the one particular one that people say did it more than anything else was Upstairs, Downstairs. And today, you know, that's still one of the very best series there's ever been. You may remember the wealthy aristocratic class in London, and then the servant class down below. And this went on for 3-4 years. And it wiped out attendance in many churches because the program was so good, and it came on PBS. And it that one, and just to bring it to the English side of it, that one helped bring down the prayer meeting in Sunday night in England. But another one did also, and that was the dog obedience show. I'm trying to remember her name. No Bad Dogs. Elizabeth, what was her name? But anyway,
she did the walking.
She did the walking, but people got so excited about this, and it was on television. And of course, I suppose you could say the British probably have a greater fondness for pets than we do. But basically, the Sunday night prayer meeting is, with a few exceptions, is a thing. It's a thing of the past. Okay. Now, more statistics on this. for instance, and I have to tell a story here, it's things like PTA, the enrollment in PTA, which is about as classic a voluntary association as you can find in this country, has gone from 12 million to 7 million people. And there doesn't seem to be much sign to be optimistic that it's going to improve. Now, I say that because, and I, well, I'll just say it and then you see what you think. I said this last year here when I was doing this particular presentation, and the hand went up right away, and the person said, the PTA in Chautauqua, Wisconsin is doing just fine. I was happy. I mean, really, I'm really glad that the PTA in Chautauqua, Wisconsin was doing fine. We got a lot of kids at St. Olaf Hall, the Langhaus, for instance, from Chautauqua, and it's a burgeoning feeder for church-related colleges. But Chautauqua, Wisconsin is not America, I think. I didn't want to say that. And because that isn't rather nice, it really isn't nice and everything else, and if it's working there, maybe we should learn something from why it's happening there. But the answer in Kathleen Norris's book on Dakota is there isn't anything else to do on Monday nights in Lemon, North South Dakota, so you go to PTA, and then you argue and hassle and wrangle there. But anyway, that's the case. All right. The same thing is true for another classic one, Red Cross. Another very important, worthwhile voluntary association, where people come together, and what makes Red Cross work, besides our donations, obviously, is the willingness of people to help out in a voluntary basis. We had the floods of Grand Forks, just a couple of years ago that you all saw and probably were involved with in one way or another. All the floods that are taking place now, or the whenever a crisis breaks out, and Red Cross is the agency which is there, and this has gone down. And the same thing is true with Rotary, the same thing is true with Kiwanis and Lions and others that I could mention, and leadership in the in Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts also. All right. Now, you say, well, there are a couple of exceptions. For instance, you say, well, what about, and since I mentioned it before, what about AARP, which I'm sure, just for fun, how many here have their little card from $5 and you use, right? That's where I got off the subject, wasn't it, with Ogallala, Nebraska, right? It's about as lively as my hometown, so I'm not putting down, if you're anybody you're from here, from Ogallala, they pay their taxes and they obey the laws, and what else can you expect anymore? So anyway, counter trends. But the problem with AARP is that it consists almost entirely of people sending in their dues and not doing anything sort of on a local basis. AARP is strong, and thank goodness it's strong, and I'm glad to see AARP really rattle some of these senators in Washington, and some of them really get mad at AARP because they're such a well-organized lobby. But when they start talking about cutting Social Security or something else like that, at least we've got a voice that's there. But that's really just about basically all that the AARP does. It works on the national level, but it doesn't attempt, obviously, to bring people together locally on this. Or another counter tendency might be this. And I do this with another series that I have up here. There is a very strong movement in what we call small groups within the churches. Robert Withnow, who studied this, he's from Princeton, has studied this very carefully, says that as many as 40% of American adults participate in one way or another, at least once a month, in a small group or organization. It might be for Bible study, it might be for people who just lost their spouse through death or divorce. It might be people who have problems with teens, all sorts of things. It could be AA, all sorts of things like that are going on. And that would indicate, just on the surface there with the statistics, that maybe there are some of these voluntary associations which are thriving and doing very well in spite of all the other counter tendencies that are going on. But what Putnam says about the small groups here is that yes, they are there, and yes, they are in a sense growing, but they are all individualistically oriented. They aren't there. They're there to help take care of people, every person's problems. Right? And I've, for instance, gone to someone, and my problem when I went to one, it was a men's support group. The other people's stories were so heart-rending and so poignant, and everything else. I just sort of felt, why am I here? My problems don't even compare to how significant these are. Seeing men cry and hugging, all the rest of these things, made mine feel pretty insignificant, because some of these people had some big, big problems. And the story I have to tell here is when Garrison Keillor went to his first Lutheran support group meeting. I don't know if I told this one here. All right, anyway. He came out of a very strict fundamentalist background up in Hokan, and the Separated Brethren, I think that was the name of the group, And then he gradually moved out here, and then finally he got into, back into Lutheranism again and joined. And when he was in New York, he found this wonderful Lutheran church about 92nd and 5th Avenue that had a jazz liturgy and all sorts of good things. Well, anyway, he got all excited, and he was going to go to his first Lutheran support group. And he went, and there was an evening service, and it was downstairs, of course, and they all looked at each other, and the first thing they all did was hug. They looked and said how glad they were to see each other, and they hugged some more, and then they sang 40 verses of Kumbaya. And they were laughing, Lord, and singing, Lord, and dancing, Lord, and praying, Lord, and they kept on going with us, and then they hugged a little while longer, and then they sang 20 verses of Jacob's Ladder, and straight out of Bible camp. You remember Bible camp and the Saturday night dedication service and all the rest of these things, and then they hugged some more, and then they said, we had a wonderful time, and they went home. That was Garrison. He was a little bit, you know, I think exaggerating on some of these things, maybe more than a little bit, but maybe some of you have been at some of these, these particular ones. I've got more Bible camp stories, but I better stay with social capital on these things. Sorry. What he's saying here is that all together, when you put these things together, Red Cross, PTA, all the things, the church groups and all, there has been at least a drop-off of at least one-fourth of participation in our country since about mid-1980s. The American social capital, the goodwill on which we draw and which we look forward to, is diminishing as we go more and more, you know, into ourselves. Okay. One other exception here, it started in the 1988 campaign when Vice President Quayle brought up the idea about family values, and this caught on with a lot of people. And wouldn't this indicate, obviously, that people are taking, you know, more seriously the idea of a greater social outreach and involvement, and improving quality time, not just being, you know, individualistic and looking out just for themselves in this sort of narcissistic society which, you know, people say we belong to. And Putnam looks at the whole matter with family values and said this. Basically, it means the emphasis there is more quality time with individual families, which is all to the good, obviously, but it means less time, obviously, for local involvement with the block party or with the block. I'll talk about the block party. With the block or with the city or something else like that. He said this, neighbors, when asked in surveys, reported a rather sharp decline of involvement or socializing within the community itself. I see this, I don't know if any of the rest of you live down in various parts of the Southwest to where we have, I live in Scottsdale in the wintertime, where we have the walls. And in a way, it's they always advertise places like Sun City or Leisure World or something else like this, and they say they are gated communities, which means the walls are there usually about 5 foot high and everything else, and then you have even walls between the neighbors and everything else. It's more privacy, and the way they are sort of advertising gated communities is that there's more security because you have guards at the gate, at the entrance and everything else. And I have a very good friend, a classmate of mine, for instance, and he said he's got a lot of artwork and some very important valuables there, and he doesn't sort of want to trust anything except living in a gated community. But it does mean that if you're going to have to talk with your neighbors, you're going to have to stand, you know, and look over the wall. What was it? I had found a barber. I'd never thought of this before now. My barber had just arrived in Scottsdale, and he'd lived in Upper New York, and he didn't like gated communities at all. He liked to be able to move freely and back and forth. And I had another friend too, who lives in a gated community in San Diego, and she has twins. And she went back to her home in Hibbing, where is the ancestral home. And her twins loved it because there were no gates. They could run back and forth, and they could find somebody to play with, you know, in the neighborhood. The old games like Bump Bump Hole Away, or, you know, can is we kick the can, is that the one we used to call it? Can out. Kenyon was kind of behind on kind of things, but Red Rover come over, and NAI over. I guess so. People tell me that the kids still play those games. Apparently this is still going on. And it's fascinating. I live, I'm staying here right in Lodge 4, and I look down and I see the little ones coming to school and back from school. And they're very active in playing games. And it's absolutely fascinating to watch them. They are very serious about their games. They had three little girls about 4 years old yesterday who had their dolls. And in a way, it was competitive. I can take better care of my doll than you can. And I was beginning to wonder about one, because the other two were very kind and sort of tender towards the baby, and one, when she didn't like what the baby was doing, was took it and pounded it, you know, like this. And I don't know if that's a part of the trend towards violence in this country or not. But to rewind on this, the whole business of gated communities makes a difference. And sometimes I think it's just as well, you could say, well, I don't have to dress up. I can just go out in my shorts or whatever it is and be by myself. On the other hand, something is lost with the gated communities. And I don't know if we'll, you know, what else we could say about that. All right, so one other piece of evidence here. The polls also show that Americans are less trusting. The proportions, I'll quote this directly, the proportion of Americans saying that most people can be trusted fell by more than one-third between 1960, when 58% chose that alternative, 58% said most people can be trusted. 1993, this went down from 58% to 37%. Decline of over 20% here in the statistics on saying, can we really trust people? And this was across the country. This isn't just in, say, Manhattan or some, you know, high crime areas, or, you know, like Phoenix or Miami or something else like that. Okay. Is that clear so far on what he's trying to say? Comments or questions on this? I want to go into the analysis here of why this has happened and what this has to do with the churches also. But I think it's a fairly strong case. It created a lot of attention when it came out, and I think it's still worth looking at, because some of you, you're at a place like Holden because you have an interest in organized religious activity, and you know how difficult it has been and how difficult it is to get people out and doing things. If you didn't have the local congregation, because if you didn't have the local congregation, life would be very much more diminished. And there are those who say that the local parish is slowly but clearly sinking. Because for all sorts of reasons, but I want to probably go into this. And I think that's true in some ways, but in other ways, I don't think that's basically what's happening. Now, why should this happen? I think, first of all, there is the matter of the two-income family, or the two-career family. Now, I say that because last year, as soon as I said two-career family, some woman said, are you opposed to women in the workplace? That was her opening statement. So I want to be sure you understand I'm not opposed to women in the workplace. My first wife was very active. I was very happy to do my share. I got to be a pretty good cook and did the laundry and wash and everything else, because she was very active, and she taught at the University of Minnesota, and it was in the long run, it was a very salutary kind of experience for everybody. So I'm not opposed to women in the workplace on this. And it's like some people say, well, isn't the women's place at home? What's that old German expression? Kinder, Kuka, and what's the one for kitchen? It's church, kindergarten, and kitchen, right. Sing. You remember the KUCHE, that's what K-U-C-H-E, and kinder would be children, and then the kindergarten. That's where the three Ks. But I would always say, if that's where they belong, why are they so well qualified then for, you know, being in positions of leadership? That doesn't set well with some people. But anyway, you get the idea. 60% of adult women now are wage earners, which is the definition. Or 60% of adult women are wage earners in the country. That's a huge change, obviously. Now, what this has done is cut in, for instance, into membership and participation right away in such groups as Red Cross, League of Women Voters, PTA, and all the rest. There simply isn't time. And all the studies that I've shown say that there is less leisure time today, even with higher wages and everything else, than there was even 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, that there is less leisure time. There is simply more things taking place that cut into what you might call discretionary time, where people had more of a choice to do this or do that. It really got started with the suburbs and the suburban boom right after the war. But I think that's going on all this. Okay, but I think that's part of it, but there's much more to the situation than simply the number of women and now wage earners. A second one, a sort of a social force, I think it's very important here, and this directly affects church life also, is the huge increase in what we would call mobility in the country. People move much more easily, much more quickly, and sometimes they have to move. The hypothetical situation, if you're working with, let's say, a big company like American Express or Prudential or something else like that, if you want to go up and there is a promotion in Denver and you're living in Cincinnati, obviously you want to do more for your family. You want to have the rewards of doing more for your company. So you move from Cincinnati to Denver, and that means sort of starting socially all over again. That means pulling up the roots in your PTA or your Boy Scouts or Campfire Girls or whoever it was back in Cincinnati and having to start over again. And what is it? 1 out of every 5 Americans moves every year. Some huge statistic on that. It's just quite. You see the big things, or you see the Ryder trucks, or the Penske trucks, or the what's the other one? U-Haul. Yeah, Adventures and moving them. When my son moved, we had an adventure coming back from New Haven to Northfield. That was an adventure. I won't go into the details, but it was the what was it? The water pump went. Might as well tell the story. We put too much stuff in the back. He was coming back to Minnesota, and we put too much stuff in the back, and we're cruising along, and all of a sudden we're New Haven. We crossed the George Washington Bridge, and I noticed that some of the gauges didn't look all that good. And we got to a big trucking plaza in Pennsylvania somewhere. I forget the exact name of it, and the fellow. We said, let's put up with water, and the water went right through, of course. And as it turned out, you can call it providence, you can call it luck, you can call it anything. It was the weekend of Labor Day, and we needed a water pump. This was on a Saturday night, and of course, things were going to be closed on Sunday also. And they said, well, maybe we can take care of it tomorrow. This was 1 a.m. in the morning. In Bloomberg, that's it, Bloomberg something, Pennsylvania, right, 80 or wherever it was. And we were, you know, pretty nervous about this. We got the last room at the last motel there, for one thing. And the next morning, we went in. This was Sunday morning, the long weekend. And we said, what we need is a water pump for a 78, what was it? It was the old American Motors car. I forget the exact model, but the American, the one that... I forget the name of it. Anyway, it's a car that looked like a bulldog, sort of short and squat and low and everything else. But anyway, they went back, and on a Sunday morning, they said, what do you know? We've got a pump. We've got a water pump for you. And we said, well, you know, that's fine. We sort of figured we'd have to hang out there for a day or two. And they said, we can put it in right now. And so they put it in now at 9 o'clock, and they put it in at 1 o'clock in that afternoon, and we were back on the way again. So how does that have to do with what I'm talking about? Mobility, that's what. That is one of those rare things. We could have still been sitting there, you know, for all we knew. But it does mean that people aren't able to sort of build up goodwill over a long period of time. You get, you know, a new guy and new people on the block, and you sort of look at them for a while, and you check out their... You know, you check out their furniture, and you check out their appliances and all the rest of these things, and that brings up an Ole and Lena joke at this point, because this was the Ole and Lena were living in town. They got new neighbors, okay. And they were looking at the neighbors coming in and back and forth and everything else, and after about 2 weeks, Lena said, Ole, come over here and look at something. And she said, what? And she said, now every time, you know, her husband leaves the house, he kisses her goodbye. And Ole said, okay, that's what he does. He kisses her goodbye when he leaves for work. And she looked at him and she says, Ole, why don't you do that? And Ole says, why should I? I don't even know her. That's a good joke.
Oh, yeah.
That's an Ole Lena joke you can tell in church. And that's where I heard it. It was down in St. Peter's in Mesa, where the visitation pastor brings in an Ole and Lena joke every time he does an announcement. So anyway, mobility. I think that's very, very important. Another one that sometimes people aren't aware of, but maybe many of you are, that actually in terms of sharp comparative analysis, there is less real wages, there is less real money for participation in these things than there was 20, 30 years ago. Wages, salaries have gone up, but in terms of hardcore analysis, we're making less money. I remember myself vividly when I started teaching in 1956. I had a PhD, and my opening salary was $4,000 a year, and we thought that was pretty good. We really thought my first car was $1,600 total, and my mortgage was 4%. This was enough to get by with. And gasoline was 29 cents a gallon, and I'm sure you could go on with a nostalgia on that sort of thing, and taxes weren't that bad. But anyway, there's been a decline in real wages, and thus there is less money to spend in things like we would call socializing and some of these other things that are taking place. And another one, clearly, this wasn't in Putnam's, but I think this is the case. Clearly what's happening is and we still aren't able to judge the full impact of this, the whole business with gambling and casinos in this country, I think has made an enormous difference that we are just now beginning to understand. The whole thing with casinos, if you want to call it gaming, fine, but it's gambling. What was it last, 1994, where they have good statistics, something like $50 billion were spent, in legalized gambling, which wasn't being spent before, which means people are spending more time, obviously in the casinos. You can see that if you want to see where people are on Sunday morning, they're either in a Mormon parking lot or in a casino parking lot. We went through once, there were just some new casinos in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and we were there for a wedding on the Saturday before, and so we just sort of toured around in Baraboo, and all the casino lots were jam-packed at 10:30 on Sunday morning. And they report this everywhere, and it's not going down any. There's a thing now in Arizona. They're trying to they're trying to get casinos within a mile or two of the state university. They're sort of losing control about how bad this what can happen here, and the governor has put a stop to that. But basically, I think people are spending much more time in money and energy really in casinos. It's become entertainment. I've got a whole long sermon here, but this would be preaching to the choir if I delivered this sermon. So, but they're spending more time and more energy. It's becoming their entertainment. I'll tell you, when I had my little accident here, I had one of the women who was helping it out, and she had spent 5 days a week taking care of people like me, and she said the only excitement, the only quote glamour I get in my life is the 2 days I get to spend at the casino, with all the lights and the noise and the excitement and the possibilities of making money. And they bring in famous superstars singing and all the rest of these things. And I think this has made a real difference in terms of we know, for instance, we've got good statistics in Minnesota that one reason that the Twins are doing so poorly in attendance is that people are going to the casinos for their entertainment rather than going to the Twins games. Yeah.
Another type of parking lot that's tending to get fuller on Sunday mornings is the hardware wholesale and other specialty superstores.
Yeah, the blue laws are gone, and you can make out a case for them being gone. But on the other hand, it does make a difference with this home base, Home Depot, I'm trying to find things. Is there one now called 84? Is that the name of a big lumber? Somewhere. 84, right, yeah. They do the same sort of thing as Home Depot, and this is the Menards, these are the ones in the Twin Cities that are popular. Yeah, Warren, you've got it.
The casinos and is that a result of the lack of community, so you have to go there, or cause it,
That's a good point. I mean, people are looking for community, you're saying, and so they go, they can't find it somewhere else, or they won't find it somewhere else, so they go to the casinos. Yeah, that would be this health aid at my rehab center. That's why she went for community. Yeah. And there was some excitement there, too, and all the noise and the color. And I remember once we just we walked down the strip in Las Vegas, and we went into, what's the famous one, Caesar's Palace. And it was exciting. I mean, it was really, this should certainly be the Main Street in Kenyon, Minnesota. or here one night, I remember it was the dead of winter, and it was Dan Erlander and I, we had Vespers here, and we went outside, and it was just, the fog was so thick, we couldn't even see our hand out here. Dan said to me, what hot spot do we have tonight? There wasn't much going on here, but who knows what would have happened if we got to the local casino. But I think this is true. They're looking for community, but it's taking away time and energy from the things like Red Cross and League of Women Voters and others, right?
Downward spiral that's going on.
Yeah, I really think there's something to that. Yeah, in the back.
I was just saying, besides the two income families, the whole problem of commuting is a reflection of declining real wages, and you're further and further and further out, and people expend the time and they're more exhausted. And by the time you get home from long commutes, it's too late to get involved with going out to the evening.
Right. Life is less attractive in the inner cities, and so some people, they want the better schools. We're seeing this in my little town, Northfield. It's 35 miles away, but the I don't know if you've been there lately, Sig, but it's booming in terms of people from the cities commuting there, and a whole new community is growing up. And very surprising, but that's what they want. That means they don't have a whole lot of time or energy for some of the other worthwhile things. That's true.
People in New York are living in Pennsylvania.
You're right. And
you're talking 2 hours one way.
Yeah, right.
But I see something from post-World War II. Changes were slow at that point, but they were the crucial things. The talk about the blue laws, about prayer taken out of schools, and I think the downfall started then. And people started to get away from church even that far back. I think that it all snowballed. In time, we just went rolling down a ski slope because of the laxity of community, of discipline. I want to say this, but it's my feeling that, Dr. Spock.
No, Benjamin.
Had a little bit something to do with this because we had to let the children express themselves, which I could not allow my children to express themselves in the way he thought. And I saw too many kids expressing.
Permissiveness, right. You had the feeling sometimes when you visit your grandchildren, boy, I wish I could, take care of them, right? Does that sound familiar? Right? We would straighten them out in a hurry, right? But I've learned one thing, you don't tell your children how to raise your grandchildren. If you want to have family discord instantly. Right, rings a bell here with some of you, right? And the one with me is, I'll eat what's on your plate. That just drives me crazy. I grew up in the Depression, and we're glad to have food. And seriously, we're glad to have food. And now, I don't want to start, and that's like preaching to the choir again. But I think there's something to that, very much so.
Yeah.
And they say on some other things, like specific health issues, that some of the advice there was very good about formula and some of these other things. But clearly this sort of thing. Okay. The last issue, or the last cause besides the ones that we've talked about here, of course, would be television. Because over the long run, you have to add in things that started up about the time the decline of community came, and we didn't have commercial television really to any great degree until about the mid-1950s and the early 1960s. Just to give you the statistics here, in 1950, less than 10% owned television in this country. By 1960, this was up to 95%. And maybe some of you remember Captain Muntz, wasn't that the name of a television brand or something? And it doesn't ring. I'm trying to do some
Muntz TV.
What?
Muntz
TV, right. Then there was some captain guy in there that they were running around. It was a terrible, I don't want to start on that because 95%. It was the fastest diffusion of a technological innovation ever recorded. That spanned from 1950 to 1960. And the viewing hours per capita has grown from 17% in the 1960s to over 50% by the 1990s. That is, it is more than 59% higher in the 90s than in the 1960s. People are working much more. The average, and this next statistic is somewhat iffy, but Americans watch roughly 4 hours of television per day. Some people say 3. We got an argument last year over this, and the fellow got so mad he walked out, but I'm kind of glad he went so we could get on with the program. But anyway, 4 hours a day. Television as the primary activity at home absorbs 40% of Americans' free time, as the discretionary or free time, and that's an increase of 1/3 in 30 years. Multiple sets have now proliferated to where over 3/4 of all homes have at least 2 sets. And maybe if you think back on yours, maybe there's 3 or 4. They have the different size. You've got probably 5.
No. We have one television that we use, our VCR.
Okay.
We have no television reception.
Write a book and tell it, as I said last night, sell it and bottle it so we know what, bottle it and sell it so we know how that might work. There's always the thing, when the TV breaks, people think, after about a week, isn't this wonderful? We didn't know that this existed before. Right?
And in 2 years, you'll read this about the internet.
I'm coming to internet too, yeah.
That's right. That is a captive of the country.
That is a major thing because in one way it's magnificent. You can get more, I'm a teacher, you can get more information out to more people more quickly and more with more choice than has ever been the case, before. And it's going to impact, it's already impacting on churches. for instance, because people can look up their own information and authority and commentaries and dictionaries and encyclopedias on some of these things, and all that's to the good. Email, my last The Bicycle book, I did the whole thing on email. The editor was out in Vermont. And we could write to each other, you know, instantly, and speed it up, these things. And one reason, obviously, the post office is in decline is that it's taking up all that first-class postage, as was the case before. And the chat rooms are healthy, but on the other hand, it's one person looking at one screen. Mm-hmm. And you're not rubbing shoulders, and you're not looking, you know, you're not singing the hymns and praying together and doing all the things, or being in PTA or Red Cross or anything else on this. And that's not, and they're making television, I mean, they're making internet so more reasonable now that it's going to be available. And I don't see, my own problem is, I don't see how this is going to be, how you can stop this. The only thing you can do is, you know, work for better education and have programs that can actually bring people together from, we had Wes Preeb's brother here, was here last year, and he said what happened with Arrow Seniors is that they would meet like once a week or once every 2 weeks and get information and instruction and all these sort of things. Then what they would do is talk about it, you know, afterwards. They'd go out to coffee or lunch or something else like that. And that seemed to be, to me, a very nice balance, because the internet can do things like bring information into homebound people that they wouldn't have before in entertainment. And I love, for instance, on cable, I love old movies. And I can get old movies there. You can get old movies at the Mr. Blockbuster and everything else too, but you can get them on, AMC and Bravo and the two free ones. And, when you can see, like a Danny Kaye musical. I mean, they're wonderful things to have. Instead of, I always use the example of having today Bruce Willis, you know, on a rope, smashing his way through windshields and blowing up the Empire State Building and doing all sorts of things. And to see a Danny Kaye thing, that's great. But then there should be the opportunity for getting people to try to do things. Now, the ELC is trying to do something here. Marty, for instance, with a couple others, has a program of 6 videos where they do straight sort of Lutheran doctrine, and then they, for about 20, 25 minutes, and then they have questions and discussion for people. So you know you're getting, this is an advantage, because you know you're getting the very best with an authority like Marty, and then have people talk about these things. But that's slow and coming up. This is a good one. This is where the evangelicals are way ahead of the mainline churches. I'll give you an example in Phoenix. There's a Bible, sort of a Bible college called Southwestern, and every year they put on sort of a computer fair, and they have 25-30 producers of CD-ROMs and all these sort of things which are there, and the only person, the only firm within the mainstream that even came close was Missouri, had the publishing, or Concordia had an exhibit there. None of the others did. Presbyterians, Methodists, Lutherans, or anything else. And they're getting the market, because in a huge city like that, people, especially younger people, aren't all that interested in denominational loyalty. They'll go to a church which they said has a good youth program, that has parking, has nice music, and that's basically what they want. And if the software is evangelical, that's what they'll take, because they want to bring it home and give it to their kids. Right?
Well, on our parish, we were writing kids by email because they don't read the ordinary mail anymore.
Yeah, right.
They go home from school and read the email every night. So the youth person was sending all the kids email, all the stuff, mm-hmm. because that's where the kids are at,
right.
Not in the ordinary mail.
There are courses now you can take just on email, and in that sense, I think it's adjusting to the inevitable. You can't change it, so the thing to do is to work within the system. And what is it to the old Serenity Prayer? Give me the courage to change the things I can, patience to accept the things I can, stay changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. And obviously, it's here, but it can be. They already have 12-step programs, don't they, for internet addicts? I've got a friend on it. I don't want to mention any further. You might know him, and he's total. He's in Chicago. Total. And he does all sorts of good things. He's setting up programs all the time and doing things. And just in a different sense altogether, it's helped my wife. She's very interested in Lutheran theology, and there are 3 or 4 nets that you can subscribe to. And I usually go to bed around 10 o'clock, and sometimes I wake up at 12 or 1 o'clock, and I see that little silver glow going, and she's there, you know, absorbing this stuff, which she couldn't have had a chance to do before. She doesn't have to go to the library. She doesn't have to spend money for books. And she can get them. They're writing about transubstantiation, or they're writing about close communion with our Missouri friends, or their, unionism, or things like this. And they're enjoying, and she's learning from it. But then she knows when to, to hit the button for, getting off. So, yeah, see.
How do you see these trends affecting Holden negatively or positively?
Did Martin talk about this yesterday? About what is going to happen with a short time? They're going to get telephones which are accessible, which can be used at Holden. And right now, they don't. There's no email. Even if you wanted to, you couldn't have email here. But now, and he says that Gates is going to have these ready within a year or so. Mm-hmm. And the question that comes up for Holden then is that the uniqueness of Holden, and they all know this, is that separation, isolation, solitude, and all these things. But the only way that they could prevent this from happening would be to search people's luggage when they came in. And nobody wants that to happen. No, that would be, I think, worse, the greater evil on this. And they're aware of this, and the prices right now, one advantage that Holden has here is that the prices for these telephones is fairly high, and that's going to be prohibitive. Like everything else in technology, it's coming down. And by the year 2004, they're going to be as inexpensive as going down to your local Walmart and being able to buy one. $50 to $100, as we're talking about, for these things that will work anywhere, right? And so far, the board of directors here is working on this, of course, a lot. Martin's kind of tired of talking about it because he's talked about it a lot. But it's just to ask people to keep it, if they bring one, keep it in their room. Because if you're sitting out on the Ark and you're calling your stockbroker, and somebody else is talking about the mine hike, obviously you've destroyed the sense of community that that's necessary to this place. And if you've been following the stock market, a lot of people are going to be calling their brokers. But basically, that's the point, that they have to face this one, because it can't be stopped. But on the other hand, you can do some things to control it. You can ask people voluntarily, and I imagine that will be enough to make it work. But it's a strange world. And then I would have liked to have had maybe we can do it next week, have a forum on the internet and all the things that are going on there. Because other than my wife, the thing I miss is my third week here. The thing I miss most is, besides my dog, is my internet. And you get so dependent on these things. But they're having fun too with us. Two grandmas, they live on each side of us. They said, we're going to get the kids to write. We're going to give them, their sense. And because, it's like the old Jewish mother, she's always complaining that her son never calls her. So what they did was give their children, the computers with all the equipment, everything else. They don't even call, they don't even write now, because it's so easy, with email to write, and that isn't working out. But they sort of joke about it. But it's one of these unsolvable sort of things. But I think the mainstream churches, and they are doing some things like the Marty tapes, and if you have the chance, your pastors would know, where to plug in with Augsburg Fortress on these things. Because otherwise, the people like my son-in-law in Phoenix, they'll go to, frankly, the Mormons, or they'll go to the assemblies or something else like that. Because this is what's attractive and appealing to these people. And the assemblies people and the others are ready with this stuff. I mean, they're way out ahead. Yeah, very way out ahead. And I've got to be ahead of my dirty dishes, so I'm going to close it down at this point. So, okay. It's 11:30 and we've had an hour. So, okay. Thank you. Good comment.